Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Daniel Foster of National Review Online in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. But as always, we have good news, bad news, crazy news for conservatives. Dan, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the good news. And we kind of saw this coming, and he's even been pretty upfront about his position on this issue. But he's obviously been a leading promoter for the Gang of Eight bill, and that's Florida Senator Marco Rubio. Certainly the one guy in the mix, if you had to use the old Sesame Street line, one of these things is not like the other. He's kind of the guy that you were a little bit surprised was in there, but passionately argued for most of the provisions in the bill. I think there's still some things that he would like to see that most conservatives are squeamish on, but one thing that he is demanding is border security. On top of that, he's also once again confirming, as Bob Menendez did, that right now the Senate doesn't have 60 votes to get this done. So that's, first of all, good news for conservatives. Secondly, Rubio talking to Hugh Hewitt on Tuesday, saying that he is not going to get behind this thing unless changes are made that strengthen border security. Here's what he had to say.
Well, I think if those amendments don't pass, then I think we've got a bill that isn't going to become law. And I think we're wasting our time. So the answer is no. If they don't pass, then we got to keep working to ensure that we get to a bill that can become a law. And so if those amendments fail, we got to go back to the drawing board and keep working until we can figure out one that will pass. But I don't understand why anyone would be against it. Since I don't think there is a good reason to be against strengthening border security for our country.
Now, I talked about some other things that we probably wouldn't be quite as excited about. But, Dan, he's consistent in making sure that border security is an issue here. I think the larger thing is, though, that he still seems to be willing to get the ball rolling on that rather than making sure the border is actually secure before going through with the legalization efforts and so forth. But the fact that he's where he is on this is better than we probably thought he would be.
I think the good news from a kind of forest level view is that there aren't 60 votes. My preference on immigration has always been to chop it up into a bunch of small bills and do it one piece at a time. That's kind of the rhetoric that Rubio has been using, but he said some confusing things. Like he said the other day that he doesn't want there to be a lot of horse trading on different issues in this immigration bill. But of course, that's exactly what the structure of the bill is. It's conservatives get a little and liberals get a lot in this case. But, I think the better news is that the bill as it stands doesn't have 60 votes because the bill's still pretty bad. The more questionable news is what Rubio's plan was here. I mean, we've talked about this at the office, kind of around the water cooler quite a bit. I don't know if he had a plan. I mean, everybody thought that this was some sort of grand strategy Rubio was adopting, maybe in advance of a 2016 presidential run to bolster his bipartisan credentials, do some minority outreach on behalf of the GOP. But the more we hear him say things like, well, I don't even know if I'm going to support the bill. And at the end of the day, imagine he can't get strong enough border security provisions and he backs off this bill that basically would not have happened without his passionate support. It's going to be a weird thing, and I don't think it's going to redound to his benefit. So it raises the question about whether this was a part of his plan all along or whether he was just kind of winging it.
Possibly true, but he also, you know, trusted Chuck Schumer and Dick Durbin and Patrick Leahy, and that's always a dicey gamble. And I think he thought that they were more serious about some of the more conservative aspects of this than they turned out to be. And we'll see how these amendments fare on the Senate floor with a 10-vote Democratic majority. My guess is most of them probably won't go through, and that might mean actually good news for us because it means these other provisions that we don't like get scrapped. So on to martini number two now, and Dan, in your state of New Jersey up there, just yesterday, Chris Christie kind of laying out the roadmap for what's going to happen with the vacant Senate seat following the death of Frank Lautenberg early in the week. Christie had several options here. He could have appointed an interim senator all the way to the end of Lautenberg's term in November of 2014. He could have made the special election the same day as his own reelection bid in early November. Didn't do either of those. Instead, he's calling for a special election. He will appoint a very interim senator who he says will be a Republican. But he's setting the stage, obviously, for Democrats to probably win the seat in October and then obviously have an incumbent Democrat in good shape to win the full term in 2014. Here was Dick Armey, former House Majority Leader and former FreedomWorks Chairman, with his reaction on CNN yesterday.
You know, this is what really rankles conservatives. There's not a Democrat governor alive that wouldn't seize the opportunity to appoint a Democrat senator, and no matter what the state is. Matter of fact, in some states, they might even go try to sell it and get rich off it, as they did in Illinois. But all Christie had to do is appoint a Republican. That's the correct move for him to make. Now, I put it down as debilitating stupidity, because my first rule of politics is don't lose the friends you already have for the friends you're never going to get.
So there you go, Dan. When we saw Democrats in Massachusetts change the law to help themselves after Ted Kennedy died, I don't think that appointing a Republican in New Jersey would have been all that politically toxic for Christie, who I got to think is pretty much a lock at this point.
He didn't have any great options, but it would have been nice to see him spend a little bit of his 30-point lead in some of the polls to do something good for the party and the cause that he purports to represent. So I think you're right. I think the best option would have been for him to appoint a senator through 2014. I think he would have gotten a little blowback for that. It would have done a little bit of damage to his bipartisan credibility. But like I said, he's got popularity to bleed. I mean, if you're not going to spend political capital and goodwill, what's the point of having it? The second best possibility would have been, and this would have been more Christie-like in my opinion, would have been to schedule the election for 2013 to coincide with his own. And he could have come out and said, look, I could have spent $25 million of taxpayer money to schedule this a little earlier and keep Cory Booker off the ballot with me, but I didn't want to play politics. And you know what? I'm going to win anyway. I'm Chris Christie. I'm full of bluster. And he would have won. You know, what he did here is, I think, the third best option, which is to not only spend a bunch of taxpayer dollars on a special election 3 weeks before a regularly scheduled general, but to come out and say, I don't care how much it costs, in direct kind of contravention of his image as a fiscal conservative, including a guy who supported, by the way, in the past, consolidating school board elections, which in New Jersey were in April, and general elections. Why? To save money. So it's a little bit odd. I will say this on the positive side, talking to New Jersey Republicans, and last night I was actually at Governor Christie's victory party for the it was primary night in New Jersey last night. I'll say this. Republicans down the ballot think that their best chance to flip the state house in Trenton, and they have a shot to do it in the Senate, much longer odds in the Assembly, is to have Chris Christie the biggest name on the ballot. So they want to be alone on a ballot with Chris Christie at the top. They don't want to share that ballot with Cory Booker either. So it would be a huge coup, I think, for the national GOP to flip the state house in Trenton. Like I said, is it a lock? No. But if there's a chance to do that, this might be one way in which, at the end of the day, in the long run, if Republicans in Trenton can win, then it will be good for the national party. So that's the one caveat I'd add to it.
Dan, obviously, Geraldo now believes he is not going to be a candidate either for the appointment briefly here or in 2014. So that begs the question now, are you making yourself available to the people of New Jersey for this interim appointment?
You know, I've been very flattered by the thousands and thousands of calls I've heard to appoint me. Unfortunately, I do not pass constitutional muster. I will not turn 29 until June the 11th. So anyone who wants to send presents next week for my birthday, you can send those to National Review headquarters in New York. But unfortunately, I do not meet constitutional muster. I won't be 30 until the Lautenberg's term expires. So I might run then. Who knows? But I, as a Jersey resident, I have to say, if appointed, I will not serve. Or I should say, if appointed, I cannot serve.
Well, let the Draft Foster 14 campaign begin, I guess, then. On to martini number three now, Dan, and we all know there's all sorts of fraud within the federal government. This one is particularly fun, especially since now it's been admitted to. This happened in North Carolina, Fayetteville, North Carolina. A former postal carrier there who was receiving workers' compensation benefits after injuring herself on the job pleaded guilty to fraud in federal court Monday. This is from hotair.com. Kathy Wrench Cashwell's claim that she couldn't lift mail trays into a truck due to a 2004 on-the-job shoulder injury was called into question in September 2009 when she appeared on The Price is Right and spun the big wheel twice. According to an indictment filed in September 2012, Cashwell raised her left arm above her head and gripped the handle with her left hand. On the second spin, she raised both arms above her head and gripped the same handle with both hands. Now, Dan, we both know that it's hard to spin the wheel if you just watch these people on there, and especially that second spin is tough when you're trying to get an exact change amount there. But this woman was also seen lifting furniture and doing a little zip lining. So of all the ways to get busted for fraud on national television, trying to get into the Showcase Showdown must be pretty high on the list.
Yeah, it's probably the second stupidest thing you'll ever see on The Price is Right, besides those people who bid $1 below the person next to them. They yes. clearly don't understand The Price is Right rules. And the other mistake here is, you know, you see it all the time, and I wish I could open a clinic or something. You don't want to overspin the big wheel. You don't really want to put your shoulders into it. You don't really want to put your knees into it. I think the gentler spin's the way to go. You have more control. You know, the goal should be to get the wheel around once and hit that $5 mark. I mean, and I think if she had followed good form in this case, the wonderfully named Miss Cashwell would have saved herself a federal rap.
That's probably the worst CBS fraud exposed since Richard Hatch won Survivor and then refused to pay his taxes on it. Dan, thanks as always for filling in today. We'll talk to you later in the week.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Daniel Foster, news editor at National Review Online. He'll be back with us on Friday. Jim Garrity will be back tomorrow. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us then for the next 3 Martini Lunch.